Start with introductions. Introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Ben, council member and co-chair of this committee.
TJ, council member.
Marina Clark, council staff. Jen Kess, council staff.
David Jordan, council staff.
David Gonzalez, council member.
Thomas Lauber,
government co-chair.
Steven Spano, HCAP staff.
Larry Thomas, council member.
Eric Sutter, committee co-chair. Let's take a look at the agenda for today. Any opposition to approving the agenda as written? None. The agenda is approved. Take a look at minutes from last month.
And a number of other groups are sponsoring a town hall on methamphetamine use and community responses. It's going to be at the LGBT Center on Monday, September 9th. I think it's 6:30 to 8:30. And I'm going to have flyers, and I'll send that out to send it around to council members. And this is in conjunction with the meth task force that Supervisor Mandelman has convened. And we'll provide some community input to the meth task force. So we're looking for folks who want to come and either talk about the impact that methamphetamine has, particularly on the LGBTQ community, and community responses to what works and what doesn't work.
Thank you. Is
and
that in the evening?
Yes, it's going to be in the evening. I think it's 6:30 to 8:30. It might be 6 to 8. I'll confirm and send stuff out with the council staff to send around folks.
Task force members are encouraged to participate.
Yes, absolutely. We would love to have task force members, and we'll be sending, it was announced at the last task force meeting, we'll be sending it out to the task force. Particularly for community engagement folks in the community planning council and issues around substance use and substance users to help us in the room for what's exciting to say.
Thanks. Any other announcements?
Yeah, so I guess I'll start with the trends that there was a significant number of increase to outpatient service issues, a number of clients' behavioral issues stemming probably from their, almost certainly from their disabilities, not having proper diagnoses for some of them. There's typically been very good response from the service providers. I'm still seeing a white space for service providers providing mental health services. They tend to be scarce. They also seem to be, this is a trend that I'm just noticing in my third month of doing this job, but it seems to be that accessing those services, there's a barrier to accessing those services with case management, non-medical case management. Because a lot of the people that I'm seeing, a lot of the consumers that I'm seeing that are not showing up to their appointments or not accessing the mental health services that we have gained access for aren't showing up because they don't have the support to show up. A lot of them are requiring intensive case management, and they're also going through some traumatic issues, most of which is housing related. So those issues tend to be like the crux of the issue, the problems that I've been seeing and trying to remove barriers for. I think that pretty much wraps it up. We're all basically in the housing department. Were there any specific questions about the cases that were?
Was it at more than one service provider?
Yeah, there's been multiple service providers. In a lot of instances, it's not that the service providers are not providing services. It's that they either don't have the resources or can't manage the behaviors.
Sure.
I appreciate the brevity. So,
and please feel free to give me feedback on that. I'm still kind of
jumping. No, I'm
jumping
serious.
Into.
Sorry. Usually I'm not, so I can appreciate that too. But what, can you say a little bit more about like what's actually needed per se? Just a very wide stroke.
So intensive case management seems to be the biggest issue. I've had to personally walk some clients over to services, but I can't do that for every appointment that they have, and they won't go otherwise. And in some instances, I'm sure everybody's familiar to a certain extent about the eviction process, but oftentimes when we're resolving an eviction, it includes some sort of stay agreement, but the consumer will need to access mental health services because their behaviors are getting them kicked out of their housing or challenging their housing. So getting them to access those services is the challenge because the behavior is directly associated with their disability, which is directly associated with not showing up to appointments. So having somebody to handhold that is a challenge. When they show up in my office, I can do something about it. But when they're not in my office, I don't have anything to do about it.
Okay, that's helpful.
Do you think that, in years gone by, there was a more of a peer advocacy sort of model happening for a lot of these? Do you think that that their need is could only be met by intensive case management, or do you think something along the line? Because I feel like there's like social workers who are very well connected and do a lot of linkage to care. Then there's like sort of case managers who are a little bit more mobile sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and then there's like in years past,
volunteer.
And then in the past there's things like peer advocates who do that sort of what you're describing, walking them to an appointment, because sometimes that's all that's needed is somebody to show up and motivate you to make it to your appointment.
Yeah, so I would say for the clients that I'm talking about right now, and for the for many of the consumers that I've been working with, the peer model is working and it's adequate. It's the most challenging cases where intensive case management is required,
mm-hmm.
I'm literally talking about walking them to the appointment, making sure they don't leave.
Yeah.
And following up with the paperwork and making sure they go to the next appointment. It's just not something that I think the peer model supports. That being said, many consumers have a good experience with the peer model. So it's not that the peer model is not working. It's that the service providers that have intensive case management on hand are short-staffed in that department. And, the clients, by necessity, require all of the time that they have to. I can attest to it. I've seen my time logs for providing that intensive case management for a day is, it takes a toll on your caseload. So that's, I think both are necessary. One is working better than the other. And it's more of a resource issue than anything.
Sure, okay.
Do you also think the initial accessing mental health services is difficult? Because, as case managers, we can't make a direct referral. We have to refer somebody to a medical social worker.
Sure.
Who then, they might be ready to do it that day, but if it's 2 days before the MSW gets back to them, we may have lost them.
That does speak to the process a little bit, and the process can be challenging. I know as a consumer trying to access those services, like you know, you have one, you do a little intake, then you don't hear back from somebody a couple weeks later, and then you do a second screening, and then the second screening has a waiting process, and then they hook you up with a third person. That process seems, from a consumer perspective, like it could be streamlined, but I also don't know the obligations on the part of the service providers to do all those things. It seems like they're necessary steps. If I look at it from the eyes of the provider, you know, and in extreme cases, the service providers have been cooperating with me in expediting those things. You know, if I make a phone call and I say, like, housing is in jeopardy, we need this person to stay here, I need an appointment, like, now, and we need to move past the intake process, like, now, because we've already done that a couple of times, that typically, like, the service providers have been very amenable to it. So it's not that... I think it's a multitude of issues. I haven't quite diagnosed exactly where it could be better improved, but I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but I don't know that I have an answer to your question.
In your description, it sounded like there was also a piece where there was almost like a failure of the client to acknowledge the necessity of mental health services. Is that?
Well, I mean, sure. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut
off. No, I just want to make sure that I was understanding that.
In some instances, yes. But I think that the failure to acknowledge is also part of the disability, right? So you're talking about a client who's, you know, disability. You know, a person with substance abuse, they're going to try and find help in every way from every person that cannot help them. And when you finally do connect them to that person, they're going to avoid it. And that's the behavior that needs to get managed by an intensive case manager.
Ask as a body, is there some place we can put this before we move forward? Oh, good. That was a stupid question. Thanks, Ben.
I feel like, I mean, I don't know if it's just like an expansion. I mean, I certainly something I've noticed as a person that works at an agency that provides medical case management and intensive case management. Is that I feel like a lot of these programs were designed to be sort of steps, but that there was this sort of like assumption that clients would engage medical case management or intensive case management and then sort of graduate to a lower intensity program. And I feel like what we've continued to see is that those folks just stay there and they require that level of support in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm. They cycle,
mm-hmm.
and you graduate them out, and then you end up seeing.
Or they just never leave. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. They just require that level of intensity.
They become dependent on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a hard, I mean, from a provider perspective, it's a hard thing to balance. Like, how do you promote somebody's independence while also acknowledging that they require intensive support in order to manage their day-to-day functioning? So I don't know. Almost like what the answer to the question is, but I feel like just expanded capacity. I mean, thinking about the getting to zero, ICM, and then the various other medical case management programs.
Well, we're in the end of the epidemic. Funds are on the horizon. If this is some kind of continuous unmet need, I feel like I hear it a lot. I feel like what happens is it comes up in these meetings. We try to solve it. I feel like we're like the little ant trying to move the boulder. We like push at it for a few minutes and then we're like, okay, that's not going anywhere. And we feel as if we pushed at it for a few minutes as opposed to acknowledging like that's a boulder. It needs to be a long game and it needs to be thought through with funding and da da da. So how do we take it to the next step without losing the energy and revisiting this question? I mean, the Meth Task Force actually feels that that's similar. Opt-in is similar.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, most service providers are sort of acutely aware of the problem and that this is why people don't show up but often don't have the ability to either, like, leave their desk in their office and go out in search of the individual or the time and energy to, like, walk them to the appointment, and there's no one else necessarily on staff, or sometimes their peers or volunteers who also may not have the skills to work with someone who's in a particularly challenging place. So how do we, you know, I mean, I feel like if we could add those sort of like, they're not quite outreach workers, but the equivalent of outreach workers, peer advocates, to a lot of these services so that they could help people get from one place to another. And I feel like we used to have more of those people in the system, and we've kind of lost a lot of those.
Cost of living is
services.
I mean,
yeah.
It's also, I mean, another part of the flip side of that conversation is that, like, is that there used to be more, there used to be, philosophically, there was a different perspective on that a while back, and that's changed, as well as it's a high burnout role that doesn't get paid well, and with the cost of living rising, it's harder and harder to maintain people in those positions for more than 6 months to a year.
Medical case managers?
Like
peer advocates,
intensive case managers, and sort of everywhere down that are being asked to go to encampments and SROs multiple times, see multiple clients a day, and you know.
And then the extent to which, you know, clients are getting, you know, resolved out of encampments, and then it makes it that much harder to find people, and they've had that additional level of trauma, and they've lost their belongings.
Yeah.
I'm like holding my hand. So there are already models
more polite than the rest of
them. I'm like, just keep talking over. Also, because I'm like texting. There's a couple models out there right now currently in the city that do that, to just not specifically focus on people living with HIV. So you got like the HOT team, which is a radio Department of Health model. And then, you know, I'll tout Homeless Youth Alliance. That's exactly what they do. It's a really highly intensive resource, sort of based function, but that's exactly what it's done, and you get results, but it's a lot of work for just one person. Yeah, it's really expensive for just one participant. But those models are out there. I think it's sort of like, if you guys are serious about doing this and making it something that you want to like add on to either the HOT team or the opt-in or whatever, and being like, phase two, you know, this is phase two outreach, street-based medicine.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we should put this in the parking lot for this committee to follow, have the co-chairs bring it up to steering as something we may want to keep track of over the next 6 months or something. And then also, you know, you brought up an interesting thing about the encampments. Why couldn't we somehow reach out to the department that takes care of that? And I don't know, maybe it's to go through the supervisors or something. Make them have to go through everything and then pull people's meds and then have a location that people can then go find their meds when the encampments have been ripped apart. That would also probably cause the city not wanting to go through every little thing and slowly stop the encampments being broken down. So, I mean, I don't. When we're talking about medicine lockers last month or 2 months ago, I mean, why should the city be throwing out medicine that they then have to pay for again? And, you know, it just seems like you know, that's creating a whole other problem, many, many other problems. But, you know, is there a gentle policy roadblock we can put up to slow them down with that? Or, you know.
I mean, the sweeps are expensive in so many different ways, and that doesn't stop the city from both throwing money at it on the front end in terms of, you know, DPW and SFPD, and throwing money at it on the back end in terms of having to replace medications and medical equipment and all the other stuff that they.
So this came up in the homeless work group yesterday as well. So just there's obviously a political tension with regards to one department pointing at another department doing something wrong, but at the same time, it needs to be addressed. So the idea is to figure out how to move that conversation forward. So that's definitely a recommendation that's coming out of that particular body. So that's a good thing. I know Katie Burke as well has done some really good work with using just small stipends for peer support. People will do a whole lot of work for, you know, a $15 gift card and stuff like that. So the cultural competency and then giving somebody something. So I think that's a potential model as well. It's not quite medical case managers, but it's not quite volunteers, but there's, you know, there's some people that may work for, some people that won't, but just to put that out there as well. So Ben, I felt as if you had an idea of how to keep this alive.
It's more of
many,
a
hoping praise.
I hope you have a feeling.
He's thrusting it upon you to keep it.
Well, I wanted to highlight your question because I thought it was a good question, right? Because there is money coming down. And so I was going to ask, how is this information used? Does it inform what gets RFP'd out for providers that are involved in the challenges listed in these?
Well, it's definitely used. As far as the,
were you asking about the locker specifically?
No, just in general, right?
Oh, it's definitely
this
used.
Is really rich qualitative data, right? So, like, how is it used?
So, a point on that, right? Because if there's not an access, like, because oftentimes that'll be something that comes through after the fact, right? Because the qualitative data that you see on here, you won't see a whole lot of case management on here because that doesn't mean there's not a need, right? It just means that there's a wait list that's a year long to get an ICM. So I don't know that this data would be the accurate place to get exactly that bit of information. It doesn't necessarily show where the need is. It shows the ancillary. It shows more of the symptomatic parts of the problem.
I mean, again, back to what you were saying and sort of what you were talking about just now. I don't think that this is. I mean, you're saying we're talking about it and we're like ants trying to move a boulder. But the truth is, we're not just talking about it this year or last year. We've been talking about this for a decade. You know, we've been talking about this since before I was working for the council. You know, going back and looking at, you know, historical documents related to the council. I mean, and since I've been handling community engagement stuff for the council, this has been a focus. And year over year, one of our recommendations is always bolster intensive case management. And whether it's coming from us or coming from Getting to Zero or wherever, mm-hmm. or HCAP, like things like opt-in, things like, you know, like, and the increased intensive case management in the last like 3 years, the expansion of those programs, I think is the needle is moving, the boulder is moving, in some ways. It's not like there's been no movement on this, and I think that there's a lot of other forces. It's such a complex issue, but there's a lot of other forces that just like the visibility of the homelessness population, not necessarily the increase, but the increased visibility and the increased density, has everything to do with our perspective on it. And those are some, in some ways, perspective issues. Those are, you know, how we perceive it. And the issue has been ongoing. And it's been, you know, I think that we're looking to address it. And I don't know. I don't feel like it's been a thing that we're just sort of not, like, failing to address in some ways, but it's just a slow process. I mean, you know this as well as anyone.
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, there's another boulder on the other side. Great. If we have all these people to take people to appointments, there's not enough people to provide mental health services as it is. And there was an article out recently that, like, the mental health organizations that are out there are losing people left and right because of pay and not being able to afford to live here. And so, you know, it's like a multi-prong issue that, you know, unless there's a dramatic change, I don't know how we're going to really address this. You know, I mean, and you look at the top four prioritization things when we rate the prioritization stuff for the summit, it's always the same four or five things that range back and forth. Right? And you and I talked about this last week. You know,
I mean,
it's food insecurity,
and look at what the community
intensive case
that.
Management, like, you know, housing, mental health services.
Stuff.
Basic, yeah.
And the good things about this are because this is an issue that's much larger than just people with HIV, right? So there is that, you know, we've at some point the Prop C money will start flowing, and that's for, you know, mental health and substance use services, the Our City, Our Home initiative. There's a ballot initiative that will likely be on the March ballot next year around creating universal access to mental health and substance use services in San Francisco with funding for those. And so one role for the Planning Council is, as we're gathering information, sort of documenting this need, is then also making sure that the Planning Council and people living with HIV, those needs are being represented in these other conversations around how the Prop C money gets spent, around what the mental health SF ballot initiative looks like, and the making sure that people living with HIV are one of the priority populations within those groups to get services. I think, you know, as we all know, there's a bit of a perception that people with HIV are taken care of, but people with HIV are obviously in all of these different services, and the HIV funding we have is not sufficient to meet all these needs, obviously. So, you know, sort of documenting the needs for intensive case management, making sure that as we move forward with priority setting that we're saying this, and then as, and the epidemics money, as Prop C money, sort of making sure that that's also being focused on these needs as well. And so I think it helps to be able to have documentation and say, these are the things, the first places that we would want to see additional funding go to, even if we don't have space in our, you know, Part A dollars for it.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, I feel like I did, but on that point, it's not that I can't report on that stuff. I'd have to think about the best way to report on services that are not available, but I wonder if that would help the department to get access to funds, if I could find a way to document that, or if that would help bolster an argument for, maybe I'd readdress how these reports are created to assist with.
I think that it would, as Laura said, create the documentation for the need. The question is, can you fit that in?
Well, I mean, it would just be.
Kevin's like, I'm not paying anymore.
Just saying. I just think maybe, you know, I'm not trying to rearrange how things are done in the third month, but maybe over the next few months, I just heard it and I realized that the report doesn't provide what it is that is actually needed. So maybe over the next few months, I can readdress how the report is being created to see if I can provide more documentation for where the need actually is, as opposed to, like I said, the more symptomatic.
Yeah, I would be interested in that.
But Ben loves my information.
Because I also don't want you to reinvent it. But you're new, maybe you should reinvent it. You know, like,
Some things need to be reinvented.
Well, I'm looking at this, and I'm looking, if you were looking at this, you wouldn't see that, you know, non-medical case management is a huge need right now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, you would see it's been the same for the last, report at least. And ultimately that is the issue, but it's specifically, you know, intensive case management, like that's a thing. I know that there's a wait list that multiple organizations for, but you wouldn't see that from this thing, but where there's a wait list, there should be money getting thrown out, it seems.
So, from my opinion, my perspective is that you should make it yours, as I think that every HCAP who has come on has, in some ways, innovated and increased efficiency or modified the report or how they enact the role in some ways.
Okay.
And so that makes sense if you have the resources for it. We should probably move on to the next agenda item because we're about to cover some of the stuff you're talking about. Because the things that you are talking about that need to be addressed about, like, the unmet need and sort of resources that the community is asking for is what we've been doing.
Okay.
And so while we would be happy to have the additional help, it's also not like we don't do that in some ways.
Gotcha.
I should add, I mean, ending the epidemic, I think it's phase 3 that focuses on intensive case management. It might be worthwhile to keep that in mind while we're documenting with good qualitative data the needs.
Can we put this on the next agenda to talk about? I mean, I think it would be a good opportunity to innovate it where we can, your role and what might be needed.
I was going to suggest maybe that even like Ben and I can just sit down with Steven and brainstorm some ideas, and then
that'd be great.
Maybe just come up with a couple prototypes or ways to tweak the reporting.
It might help this.
Yeah.
Or group as
are you
well.
Up for that, Steven?
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything to increase efficiency.
I know he loves innovation, so I'll have to ask him.
You said prototype.
You got a
I did get a tingle. Yeah.
I mean, one of the functions of this committee is pulling together information both from HCAP and from the needs assessments and the COLAs to provide to the council as part of the prioritization process. So I think any way that we can, you know, pull in information from all those sources and put them together, especially when there are areas where we're hearing from the needs assessment and the COLAs and from HCAP that something is needed, that should push it right up the list. And it's, you know, like if you read through the needs assessment mm-hmm. summary from people who are over 50, that's very stabilization.
Yeah, slightly with a slightly different context, but and if you read through last year's needs assessment around substance use, it's going to read very similar to what you were just talking about around severe need. Yeah, I mean, that is also part of the frustration is none of it's shocking. It's selling the same information year over year and trying to find ways to make it compelling and actionable.
Great. So I'll get together with him and shoot you a couple days.
That's
sort of from there. Thank you. Is there getting a zero update?
Mike is actually no longer part of this committee, so we don't have anybody from who is represents getting a zero here anymore. We have to figure out.
That's a problem.
Maybe he can send us a written update leading into this going forward.
I'll email him and just check him out about it.
Is anybody else here on the getting to zero?
Sometimes I attend meetings, but not regularly.
So before we get into the needs assessment, and we have a lot of ground to cover, I will say that so for next month, I'd like to put on the agenda the, because we will have already had the presentation for all of this material by the time this committee meets again next month. I'd like to, we've had two COLAs so far this year, I'd like to give you guys just a summary of the COLA results for so far this year. We have one upcoming, and so I think when we complete that last one, then maybe we'll look at doing a presentation to the full council. But for now, maybe you guys just want to hear what we have so far next month?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's you. I'm going to let Jen present most of this since she did the bulk of the one-on-ones. And has put the summary together. But before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this, super not scientific, it's just a snapshot of who was in the room at the time, and sometimes it can be wildly affected by the conversation that takes place in the space. And
not only is it not scientific, I also didn't take away substance users' needs assessment from the top, so should be saying 50 plus needs assessment. It has nothing to do with substance users needs assessment. So just want
to... Yep. Grayscale.
And when you look at something so many times and then you just like the blatant title is
which part is dots?
Which part is dots? Which part is participants?
The short fat one is participants. The long one is dots.
Yeah. Our color printer was not working. So.
And then this very fat sheet of paper here is... all of the survey results, raw data, it's not been sort of cross-tabbed or any of that. I will encourage you guys, let's not get hung up at this. We really do. I'd love to get some recommendations coming out of the summary from you guys that we can turn into a motion and maybe have something to vote on at full council or at the summit. This is just context for the qualitative data, so sometimes we get hung up on it and like to avoid that.
Yeah, I just wonder what the best way to go about this. Maybe we can start with our 50-plus needs assessment summary, which is the narrative. I apologize for how wordy all this is, but it was really hard to get it any more concise just because people had a lot of various things to say. I broke it up into like categories of where I was hearing the most detail. And I would say, so I have primary care, navigation and case management, benefits, housing, psychosocial support, mental health, safety and well-being, and cost of living. So other than the last two, those last two are more kind of thematic, whereas the other ones speak to actual service categories. And then the conclusions were kind of just the big takeaways when I kind of look at all of the data. I broke it down into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different kind of sections where I thought that there was kind of the biggest similarities that I was finding for the majority of folks. We interviewed 91 participants in a combination of focus groups and individual from a lot of different agencies, so we had a very diverse group of people. If you look at the age, demographics, race, gender, from the other pamphlet. I don't know. It's a lot to read, so I don't know if I should read it over. If folks want to read it first and then ask questions.
Can you like the economics of the folks?
Sure. Yeah. So if you go to page, where's the economics here?
Or before that, so there was 91 participants and only 86 turned in there.
They're prioritization dot exercises.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So for a variety of reasons, either someone left before
okay.
they did it, you know, things like that.
They get it is a little bit of a confusing exercise, and sometimes people just
give up.
Can't.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You've seen this. You know what it looks
yeah,
like.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I just the given part was the thing I was.
Primary
like,
income
sure.
source question 20.
Yeah. Thank you. On page 22. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the pages on the bottom don't seem to make any sense. They don't go in order.
Yeah, I mean, what you're going to see there is super representative of, I mean, in our general needs assessments, what you're going to see is almost everybody is 500, more than 500 and slightly more than 1,000 or just at 1,000. This one, because we interviewed more sort of the non, because we're not focusing on severe need population this year, we're focusing on what quote
yeah.
unquote special population, and so we interviewed more people who were sort of Castro-centric, who had a who had a work history or a more recent or more robust work history, and so were on private disability or had been on SSDI, and they were making, and they had a higher monthly income because of that. So that's why you're seeing that more than 2,000 number.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's exactly what I want to know. So it's like about 20% or what you just
yeah,
described.
But we did have probably 50 people that were definitely well below that,
yeah,
like
okay.
more in the $900 to $1,000
yeah, like
a month.
75% are
yeah.
under $1,000.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just sort of the standard SSI, like $1,100 a month to $900 to $1,100 a month was, I think, was the
and
bulk of the people.
I was thinking of just with regards to your summary, like that understanding who was
totally.
Asking for
mm-hmm.
this thing was
helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And we're hearing a lot of different things depending on which population we're talking to, if that makes sense. So if someone who's making maybe over $2,000 probably had a pretty different thing to say than people who are making $900. So
probably need parking.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I think if you just want to quickly paraphrase each of those items,
sure,
we can sort of get to it.
So for primary care, I would say the majority of folks felt very happy with their primary care, kind of attributing like life-saving qualities to it, especially people who had been going to their doctor for a really long time. Seemed like there was a lot of good relationships there. I did have some folks speaking about how they felt maybe that they weren't actually listened to until they had a case management manager in the room with them. They felt like they needed the case manager not only to be helpful in taking notes and asking questions and getting them there, but also to kind of up their... they just felt like they were more respected, basically. I heard that quite a bit. A lot of folks were talking about how it's quite hard for them to get eyeglasses, hearing aids, and... I should say dental procedures. So basically there were anything that was above just the basics, they were having a really hard time getting access to that, including referrals. So especially folks that were going to more public health clinics, it was hard to get a referral out of those clinics to see anyone who was a specialist. A big takeaway was I heard a lot about folks not really knowing the difference between their HIV-related symptoms and their age-related symptoms. And it was hard to find a good treatment balance between those two things, and they felt like they didn't have maybe the specialty in the aging world for them with their doctor, and they felt a little remiss to not really know the difference between those two things. So yeah, that's primary care. Navigation and case management. So a lot of folks were talking about how their intensive case manager was helping them with a lot of different things. We heard a lot of folks talking about how doctors, case managers, legal support, as well as their housing staff, all working together was a huge part in their success. So eviction prevention was happening that way. Keeping their meds intact was happening that way. So just basically having all of the providers talking, what seemed to be a big takeaway, that was the success. Let's see what else. Seemed like there was a need for some more consolidation on access points to navigation center services, so not unsimilar to what Stephen was saying. Folks felt not like they weren't sure how to get an intensive case manager, where they could go about getting this kind of help, but they knew that if they would really like that kind of help, they just didn't know where to start. And I would say that was particularly echoed with folks who either went to a doctor at a private practice or a non-public health clinic. They didn't have any idea about how they would even possibly get a case manager. That linkage was not there at all for them. And then a lot of folks talked about wanting more of a overall holistic case manager, someone that could help them with all aspects of their life, because they felt like because of bureaucracy or because of scope of services that case managers were not able to help them in a lot of ways that they really would like help. So that was a big takeaway.
Jeff, is that like, for instance, like wanting their case manager to say like manage their money?
Or the non-medical really was not helping at all with medical, and medical was not helping at all with non-medical. So it just felt like they wanted more of like a one-stop shop, someone that can help them with all of the maybe needs that they had on the plate.
So did any of them talk about, you know, utilizing the full service? I mean, most of my clients have multiple case managers because of this exact reason.
Right. Yeah, some people did talk about having multiple. Some talked about having one and they wish they had multiple. Some had none and they wanted more. So it just seemed like everyone pretty much wanted more in some capacity. Yeah. For benefits, I heard a lot more than I was expecting of folks who either had gotten cut off from Social Security or were being threatened to be cut off by Social Security, and that seemed to be a really big stressor for a lot of people. People were really intimidated when they would get those letters, and then going to Social Security 4 or 5 times, getting bad answers from different clerks, having to go back multiple times, similar to what Stephen was saying, like using ALRP, but then maybe not having someone who could go with them to the office to take these multiple trips. So that seemed to be like, actually, I was surprised by how many people told me that. And there was a sense that maybe Social Security is out to get people who have HIV. I mean, this was just what I was hearing, that they thought, oh, maybe we're not disabled enough anymore, so they're cutting us off now. So that seemed like a palpable fear. And then a lot of folks talked about either giving up on Social Security and they were just on GA, or having to start working again. There was a lot of folks who had just started driving for Caviar or, you know, doing some like side hustle kind of things in order to either make up for the fact that they weren't on Social Security anymore or just make that little extra under the table money so that they could continue to afford to live in San Francisco. So that was benefits. Housing, not surprisingly, there is not enough of it. People didn't know how to access it. They didn't know how to get on lists or who to talk to, especially folks who didn't have case managers, felt really remiss on how to get on some of those lists. The people that were in affordable housing felt unsafe, felt that they were kind of ghettoized in the Tenderloin SOMA, which is not shocking to providers, I'm sure, and that was contributing a lot to isolation because they didn't want to leave their room, they didn't want to walk outside. It was pretty traumatic, especially for folks who maybe had been assaulted in the past, or it was just like very triggering to live in these neighborhoods. Let's see. Also, a lot of folks who maybe lived in rent-controlled units in various parts of the city, who were starting to find it hard to live there because of mobility issues, but then not knowing where to go. So they're kind of trapped in their house in another part of San Francisco, and they really can't leave it very often. They're also afraid of eviction if their landlord gets sick of them being there for 30 years and not paying market rent, or when they either get cut off from Social Security or their benefits change when they hit 65, they're curious about how they're going to be able to pay their rent. So there seemed to be a lot of fear, even for the folks that were housed, on like what the future held for them.
And that includes those people who are like 2,000 plus income. It's specifically those who were looking at a severe cut in their benefits come 65.
Right. Also, the same folks didn't know maybe all the services available to them, so they didn't know, like, how am I going to get a subsidy if that were to happen? Like, how can I have someone put in a stair lift for me? Like, they didn't really know where to go for any of these things. And a lot of these folks were also people going to the private practice doctors or non-public health clinics, so they didn't really have that connection to some of these services. Psychosocial support. So a lot of folks talked about how support groups, especially ones where there was activities and outings, was really helpful. So they're just talking about how they feel like they're not able to participate in San Francisco life because they can't afford it. It makes them feel bad when people go out to dinner, go out to drinks, go to opera, things that they can't do. And so outings seem to be like a pretty big response that I was hearing. A lot of folks wanted to volunteer or give back in some way, feel of need. There was a big lot of people starting to feel maybe not needed anymore at a certain age, contributing to their isolation. And then I also heard some people say that they would like to have smaller support groups that were a little bit more intimate. They felt like there are some resources for 50 plus folks, but that they often are very big and can kind of serve a function in that way, where it's like this big kind of production, but they didn't have that sit around the circle and share and connect kind of thing happening for them anymore. And then a lot of folks just talked about mobility challenges being a huge contributing factor to isolation. Mental health. So I would say this is one of the biggest things I heard, was that it was really hard to get long-term mental health services, including psychotherapy by a licensed clinician, which is obviously probably not shocking for most of us. Folks also thought if their needs were not severe enough, that they were not prioritized for mental health care. So they thought if they didn't have some sort of diagnosis, then that they were not going to be able to be seen by public mental health services. Safety and well-being. So this was kind of just a big chunk, similar to what I talked about in the housing section, that just folks felt unsafe sometimes in the Tenderloin, not only because of the density of the population and some of the severe needs, but also because of the harassment from police on the other end. So in general, you heard that safety and a feeling of just unease in these neighborhoods seemed to be a big takeaway. A lot of clients, especially those who are homeless, spoke about needing after-hours drop-in services and weekend drop-in services because there was nowhere to go after the hours of 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And I would say even I heard a lot of women who were homeless saying that especially, that they felt unsafe after those hours, and it's just really dangerous for them on the streets sometimes, and they wish that there was a place that they could go. Cost of living, obviously not a shocker. I think what Dave was kind of mentioning before, there seemed to be this kind of group of people that maybe made just a little bit too much money to qualify for some services, but were spending a lot of their own money to be able to make up for those services that they didn't qualify for. And so they felt like they were not prioritized or they didn't have access to a lot of things. And then they also spoke about having to go back to work, but feeling maybe too old to work, mobility issues not able for them to work, and trying to maintain their health and well-being while also working just was very, very hard. So that was a mouthful. Any questions on any of those categories?
It's actually, it reminds me of the, I don't know if rhetoric's the right word, but the people who would say HIV exasperates the aging process. Mm-hmm. So it's basically, and then a lot of this is just, it's doing that same thing, like that unknown of like retirement is a stressor. You know,
yeah.
Like at what point do you have enough money? And there's like this future worry that kind
yeah.
of lingers over people, and then it seems to be exasperated.
Totally.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people that kind of said, like, oh, I'm walking on eggshells. Like, if one thing changes, then I'm going to be totally out of here. Like, I have this perfect puzzle piece situation. Everything's working perfectly, but if one thing falls, then, like, I'm dead. So, you know, so I felt like I heard that a lot.
I'm like, curious, like, the general population, though.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we have the answer, but, like, if you ask.
Sure. No, yeah, exactly.
All examples good in these age groups. Like, how many would, like, is this 10% higher than...
Right.
I was gonna, that was my question, was because I'm actually very unfamiliar with the aging.